I'm Larkin Kemp.
Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Larkin Kemp, and we are doing it live from Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium. There is 12 and a half minutes to go in the fourth quarter of Maryland's currently 6-5 lead over Georgetown in the fourth and final NCAA quarterfinal of the weekend. Larkin, we've been doing this three-man podcast for the season. We'll see whether or not it turns into a three-man pod at one point. We certainly have a game to talk about that might suggest why we're a man down. But before we get to that, is this the best quarterfinal we've ever had?
No question about it. All three games we've had that are completed go down as all-time classics. I mean, just today, Matt Traynor legacy game, 12-6 halfway through the third, Penn State comes storming back. And honestly, this game is sneaky quality as well. Like, I think Kevin Warren and the Hoyas have done everything imaginable to tighten it and make it a rock fight down the stretch. And we'll see if Carroll or whoever can make a couple plays here. But, you know, yesterday was truly can't miss television, as good as it gets.
So for me, my mind goes to 2019, where there were three overtime games. And then I forgot, but 2021 also featured three overtime games in the quarterfinals. And then a lopsided game in the fourth. But yeah, it's been an incredible weekend so far, capped off by a new attendance record for a quarterfinal. And this was something that I kind of saw coming because we had to pick up our credentials for today yesterday. And when I stopped by, they were like, oh, we've already sold 10,500 tickets. And I was like, I knew the forecast for Sunday was going to be great. And I'm not exaggerating when I say it's 80 degrees and sunny with a strong breeze to the point where it's like being on a beach where you want it to be 80, but it doesn't feel uncomfortably hot, which is like basically the last day it's going to feel like this in the Mid-Atlantic for the next 4 months. It is picture perfect for lacrosse. And so as a result, I was not surprised to learn that more than 7,000 additional tickets were sold, and we broke the 2008 record as 17,721 fans clicked the turnstiles at Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium. So good job on you, lacrosse fans.
Great job. And the right mix of programs in it, too. I mean, with Cuse back in their first Final Four and everything that happened on Hofstra yesterday. So just great to see.
No doubt. How much credit do you think we get for cultivating the fan base through this podcast?
Very limited. I think the boys on the field speak for itself. The quality of ball has been insane. And back to the brand itself of these programs. Notre Dame, probably the best example of they've built themselves into a top five fan base in the sport. Huge goal by Urksa there, by the way.
I'm going to take the opposite side of that argument, and I'm going to say that $5 off all single-day ticket options for men and women by using IslePod at checkout. NCAA.com/laxtickets and our IslePod at checkout to purchase your tickets. You've heard it all season long, and that is the reason that we've had so many fans show up. So it is going to go down one final time next weekend. We are going to be there all 4 days. Women's semifinals on Friday, men's semifinals on Saturday. Women's final, men's D2, men's D3 championship, which in and of itself is shaping up to be absolutely insane and epic. And then, of course, the men's championship on Monday. Larkin, let's get into the action. We are going to start with Penn State 14, Notre Dame 12. It was the first quarterfinal on Sunday, and it was one of the most epic comebacks you will ever find in a college lacrosse tournament game. The Fighting Irish, with 5:56 to go in the third quarter, led 12-6 after Devin McClain scored his second of two straight goals in about less than a minute. From that point going forward, the Nittany Lions scored eight straight goals. There were two main factors that led to that outcome. The first was Matt Traynor just going absolutely insane, sandwiched around a pair of Kyle Lehman goals to start the fourth quarter. We can go a little bit deeper on that. And then in the fourth quarter, the Nittany Lion defense switches to zone. Postgame, Kevin Corgan said straight up, our zone offense was not good today. And so as a result, the Fighting Irish went the final 18 minutes without a shot on goal. In the first half, Jeffrey Richardelli was absolutely fantastic in net, making nine saves. He only made one save in the second half. Jack Frastian got off to a really hot start as well. He made 7 first half saves, only had to make 2 in the second half, both those coming in the fourth quarter. There were no saves made in the fourth quarter. What were your thoughts on this one?
It was a Jeff Tambroni masterclass. Like, I think ultimately this was a tale of two halves. I was stunned that Notre Dame couldn't stop the run. Listen, when you make the decision to go zone, right, you're ultimately like dividing the field in half. You're telling the offense they can play 3v2 push-pull, and you're daring people with range to beat you to the pipe. Like, you're basically saying, listen, Chris Kavanaugh, get your hands free. Devin McClain, get your hands free. But we would prefer that to what we saw in the first half, which was kind of like precision passing, ball swings through X, and basically getting picked apart inside. But the big thing for me, and I think it'll keep Corrigan up at night and Wellner as well, I think you got to switch the matchup. You got to put Light on Trainer, take him out of the game based on what we saw halfway through the third quarter, just to stop the run, like when it went 12-7, 12-8, 12-9. A huge part of defense is just like deceptive looks, like, you know, 81, 27. Like, why not throw 90 on him and just have different length and range and force him to beat you in different ways? So it was stunning. I mean, as far as comebacks at this stage, but also against the two-time defending champ, I mean, that is as legendary a performance as you'll ever see in this sport from Matt Trainer. Just real hero ball.
You mentioned the Braden Erickson goal that put Maryland up 7-5 with 11:33 to go. Cade Goldberg just took a pass from Lucas Dudamain to get the Hoyas back within one. We've got 8 minutes to go here. Maryland ball and a Hoya down on the field behind the play. Terps got an advantage, and once again, Irksa gets topside and gives the Terps a 2-goal advantage, 7:57 to go in the fourth quarter. Irksa takes a big hit after the play, and he's going to require some treatment, so we've got both medical staffs here out on the field. So let's dive in a little bit more into Notre Dame's defensive game plan and the matchup. I asked Kevin Corrigan about it post-game, and you know, he basically said a couple things. The first is that he didn't feel like Matt Trainer was pulling Schwitzenberg out into space and dodging and beating him, and that was the way that they were getting their goals. He commented on how he was scoring in a variety of ways, and he said that was one of the things that they noticed on film, was just how versatile, how varied he was able to be from the standpoint of that production and danger. Jeff Tambroni said post-game that they felt like all week long that Kyle Lehman was going to draw the Sean Light matchup, and he said that Lehman was really excited for it. My inference is that they and Notre Dame liked the speed-on-speed, quick-on-quick matchup of Light guarding Lehman. In addition to that, I think they felt a little bit more comfortable with Schwitzenberg on Trainer, which is a little bit more of strength on strength relative to had Schwitzenberg had to guard Lehman, then maybe they would have been able to, you know, utilize that quickness in order to get around 27. And then in addition to that, the off-ball approach was what was so interesting, particularly in the first half. I felt like Notre Dame was really comfortable with on the backside being matchup flexible. And so there were times in which, without a pick, Trainer found himself being guarded by a short stick, whereas I thought that the matchup they were most conscientious of and the least likely to move was Light on Lehman. And so as a result, I felt like Lehman didn't really have much of an impact. Through the first three quarters, he had 1 goal on 3 shots, and it didn't really feel like he was dodging much, either in the flow of the offense or trying to inorganically force things. And so kind of separate from that, coming out in the fourth quarter, the first he got switched on to a short stick, and Corrigan said that shot is one that they would give up, you know, 9 times out of 10 or 10 times out of 10. It was a 15-yard righty hands-free, and that was a save you expect Richard Daly to make. And then a minute later for the goal that ended up cutting the Notre Dame lead to 1 to make it 12-11, it was kind of a lucky bounce. Lehman got switched on to Schwitzenberg, gets kind of into the middle and throws a bouncer that Richard Daly got a piece of, but I think it was the English that pushed it over the goal line. So, you know, there's something in there that's a little bit explanation. There's probably something in there that's a little bit what you were pointing to, which is just being overcommitted to the thigh. And I like the point that you made that there is the notion that just giving the offense something they don't expect has value, and you don't need to look any farther on the other end of the field, when it's hard to argue that that was what threw Notre Dame off, was that they just weren't quite ready or weren't expecting or weren't prepared for what they saw out of Penn State's zone defense.
I also think part of the hesitancy to switch the matchup was the time and situation. Like, I think they would have been quicker to go to plan B if they didn't build up the 12-6 lead. Like, I think that they fell back into a level of comfort of like, hey, you know, we're playing Notre Dame ball. Like, arrogance is the wrong term. But as we all know, like, they've played that style of defense for 20 years, and they are very, very slow to, like, adjust in real time to a true plan B, plan C. But ultimately, like, defensively, you just want to take away the knowns. Like, waking up this morning, their only goal was to limit Matt Traynor, right? It's to not allow what actually occurred. And when you have a Schmeissner Award finalist, like, I think you're going to regret not switching that matchup and just, like, slowing down the title momentum of 22 and white. But also, let's give him credit. He was doing a great job with deceptive leverage to a strong hand, getting the middle of the field. I mean, there was two he also could have had where perfect split dodge, getting downhill on the pipes, getting heavy, and just missed the net. So, incredible.
So what do you make of it at the other end of the field in terms of the Notre Dame offense? Chris Kavanaugh ends with 3 goals and 2 assists. Jake Taylor, 2 goals, only got 3 shots off. I thought particularly late in the fourth quarter, Penn State was super conscientious, collapsing to the inside, overcommitted to collapsing to the inside, to the point where I thought Taylor actually did a really nice job not causing turnovers, basically pulling the ball out and finding, managing to recycle it and find some opportunity later in the possession. This is insane. Every single Notre Dame goal was assisted. They did not score an unassisted goal. What did you think of the Fighting Irish offense?
Yeah, I think it speaks to the lack of evolution out of some of the primary ball kit. Like, Faison and whoever never developed into that, hey, I can just beat you to the middle and, like, hammer you the way a Dobson or a Sergio Perkovic or whoever used to, right? So Notre Dame's O was one-dimensional in that their path to success was through super high IQ leverage plays from 50, from 13, from 29. Those are elite lacrosse players, but that also makes it easier to zone shell them, because you can basically say, listen, we're going to take away a lot of their time and space when the ball swings through X after, like, a front side slide, right? And we're going to basically leave the high wall pass. We're going to go soft on the pipes, like soft shell. And we're basically going to say, listen, you're the only place you can beat me is here, right? And you force 77 and you force whoever to have to make, like, really high leverage plays. And that's the reality of zone. Like, zone is a very good way to know your personnel and limit the knowns. Because remember, if you take a picture at any moment in a zone, you can have 4 defensive players basically, like, hedged to the righty side of the ball for Notre Dame, which is 50, 29, 13, right? So you're begging the left-handers to beat you. And the other thing I'll say for Woj, which I'm sure he's kicking himself, is, like, what we saw late in some of their sub GLE action, and he did a great job when he was the head coach at Harvard with this stuff too. It's when you play zone offense, it's a lot of actual man up plays just against 6 set. And I think Corrigan made the point in his press conference, the last 2 sets, they actually got naked looks. They just didn't get it.
Yep.
And I think it's just that they didn't get into that flow earlier. Like, if they had done that, late third, earlier fourth, and held themselves to that, like, man up standard of ball decisions. Go ahead, Terry.
No, we got 3.5 minutes to go here in this one, and Georgetown just had an unbelievable opportunity to get one on Cage. Logan McNaney doing what he does. Really nice save down low, picks up the ground ball, clears the midfield. The Terps are going to be able to take this one down to about 215 if they decide to use the entirety of the shot clock. They got the second midfield on here with Jack Schultz and Elijah Stobaugh. We just got word that we're going to get joined by a certain Notre Dame lacrosse alum, so why don't we table the rest of this Fighting Irish conversation for the moment. Never mind. Why don't we keep this Notre Dame conversation going right now? Nick, how are you feeling?
So bad. So bad on so many levels. But where were we just talking about?
A lot of jargon, a lot of really high-end analysis, the type of thing that people don't show up to the tailgate for. I think they're here for your raw emotion.
You know, I'm gonna ask for grace in this time period. I'm gonna ask for kindness, for the type of humility and caring that I show when we destroy some other teams. How gracious I was to Ohio State last week. I think I've earned a little bit of kindness from Penn State's fandom. And what a second. First off, I know I'm going to be echoing a lot of points. What a weekend so far. I mean, holy moly. And the second half adjustments, it was the most clear example of quality coaching, defensive schemes impacting the game that I can think of in recent memory. So tip of the cap, you got me, you kicked me while I'm down, and good job, Penn State.
So Joe Bucci, defensive coordinator, former inside lacrosse intern, go into zone, and it just must just eat you up that the zone was so effective against Notre Dame's offense, huh?
And So we're in this group chat, and Eddie Glazner, I think, had a really good point. Like, I'm surprised that this hasn't been thrown at Notre Dame more often. There's really only a handful of guys that have 15-yard-plus consistent range, and I would argue that most of what Notre Dame does is mid-range and finish inside. And the interesting part to me was I could have seen a way in which the way Notre Dame was playing good offense against man could have succeeded in zone. In particular, the way that they attacked where the pass came from. So, like, they would kind of spin it around in a circle, and then at some point either a skip pass would happen or a quick 1-2 passes. And instead of, like, trying to catch and get topside, you would just sprint at wherever the ball was coming from. And it kind of lulled the defense into a false sense of predicting what, you know, where the dangerous areas of the field are going to be. And when the zone was thrown out, it kind of – you could still apply those principles. And the things that were making Notre Dame successful offensively in the first half still could have potentially, you know – had the ability to succeed in the second half, but they just completely got away from it. You know, they just tried to jam it inside. They tried to do, they tried to do a little too much.
Nick, you'll remember this from last year. We are recording, and it is currently in the middle of the final quarter final. Maryland up 9-6 with 1:12 to go. We just saw a pair of Aiden Carroll transition opportunities. The first coming after he got the ball on a clearing pass with what looked like an empty net, took a 17-yarder. Logan McNaney cuts off the pass, or shot rather, as it's going into the goal. And then a clearing pass. He basically did the thing where he sticks a stick up in the air to disrupt the clearing guy in front of him, intercepts it, and once again, this time doesn't try to take the long empty net shot, but tries to get to the mouth of the doorstep, and the shot goes wide. We got a timeout here. Terps up 3, 1:12 to go. So I think your point is incredibly well taken with respect to what some of the elements of what made Notre Dame successful offensively felt like they should have translated. Larkin made the point before you joined about how it felt like just the disruptive power of going to something. And I like your comment from Eddie insofar as one of the reasons maybe that they weren't prepared for, like, just, you know, or weren't better prepared for capitalizing on a zone is that they hadn't seen as much of it. What was your reaction at the other end of the field where the conversation today, and it's Sunday, but I'm sure this is going to be the conversation on Monday, is about matchups, and particularly the fact that Sean Light was not used to guard Matt Traynor, and then Traynor goes for 6 goals and 2 assists.
Again, I look at what made Notre Dame successful in the first half or second half. And if we're flipping from the offensive to the defensive lens, it was what I thought worked most was getting bailed out by good goaltending. I'm not saying that the team played, you know, as good as 3.5 goals would lead you to think. But in the moments that
that's
were
a really,
really
good point that I totally agree with.
Yeah. And I think, even beyond that, the moments which you're looking at there's 10 seconds left in the shot clock and they haven't gotten a shot off. And now they're just trying to scramble and throw a Hail Mary look. So like focusing more on those, it was really quality team ball, particularly as it relates to sliding and rotating. I think some of the skip passes were vulnerable from start to finish, but there wasn't a time that I can recall in the first half in which, and maybe it was because I was watching it on an airplane after, you know, about 350 bourbons last night, but there wasn't that, oh, this player's getting a full head of steam and the slide is late. Oh, the slide was drawn, and now that there's a pass to the adjacent player and there's 5 yards of approach space for Penn State's offense to work with. And so I think the entire defense like took a step back and relied too much on individual matchups, regardless of how it played out. I'm not going to, you know, say, oh, Sean Light should have been doing this. Oh, we should have done X's and O's. Because at the end of the day, Notre Dame has kind of always been matchup neutral in the sense that if we all play by the principles that we learn, then nothing should catch us off guard. And so it just kind of seemed like they leaned too far into we are comfortable with this guy dodging, and the preparation to slide and the preparation to rotate was missing.
Yeah, the reason I think that's somewhat of a false answer from Corrigan, I get the concept of it, but like, if you just take a picture when a big, strong righty is going to start it like a high wing dodge, right, and Sean Light is covering the low left alley, by definition, even if you're not matchup conscious, he will not be on ball, he will not be sliding to the ball, and he will not even be supporting the slider in terms of like making that fill decision. So like, I actually love the fact, and I'm jealous of the fact that Notre Dame doesn't give a shit about matchups, but like, I think when Penn State is so one-dimensional and that they have like one elite, big, heavy righty, not having the Schmeisser like award candidate on the right side of the field, even if he's not starting on ball, which I argued Richmond should do for Kearse, right? Is like, I actually love the notion of like, you know, sometimes it's actually wasted talent. Although Schaller is kind of shoving it down the hoop, the notion of it right now on Aiden Carroll, I will say. But I just think not having him engaged when the whole offense was playing in that alley is kind of crazy. Like, I don't think Lehman is in the same category of athlete as Matt Traynor. Like, not even close.
Nick, we got to get to talking a little bit about the Nittany Lions, but just 2-time defending national champions will not become 3-time defending national champions. Final thought.
Really? That's how you tee up the final thought? Bunch of great kids. The foundation that you know, the players that just wore the Golden Dome for the last time, it stings right now, and it's going to suck for an interesting amount of time. Whether that's weeks, days, months, years is kind of up to you. But just know that one day, sooner than you'll realize, you'll be able to look back on what you did in your 4 years at Notre Dame, maybe five, maybe whoever knows, transfer portal, whatever, and just know that you changed the foundation of what it means to play lacrosse at Notre Dame. And speaking on behalf of all alumni, we appreciate the work that you've done, juniors through freshmen. Remember the feeling and use that for when you're just ready to quit lacrosse, you know, late into fall ball or early into preseason. And it sucks, but given how good the lacrosse has been, man, Memorial Day, watch out. I have no clue what's going to happen. I just know it's appointment television.
And just Larkin, anything else? Yeah, just to build out that, what the Kavanaughs did, establishing Notre Dame not only as like an elite program, but one of the true like disruptors of the blue blood mentality of like, you can only go to Duke, UNC, UVA, Maryland, etc. to compete on championship weekend. Like, their legacy in our sport is not only secure, but fortified. Like, there is nothing harder to do than go west of the Mississippi, like grab the game by the balls and quite literally jam it down someone's throat. So I couldn't have more respect for like, A, the way they play this era of Notre Dame lacrosse, and who they are as like humans. We know Matt very well, obviously having played with him, but the whole family and really the whole identity of the program. Like, they are, Notre Dame is like full of good people, and this period will be looked at very fondly. And they're not going anywhere. They're very well coached, and they recruit at an extremely high level.
Larkin, any thoughts on the Nittany Lions before we move on to Syracuse for Princeton?
I just have a ton of respect for Tamberoni and that group. Like, I think they were more banged up than most this year throughout the season. They obviously had the big win against Cornell that floated them in the RPI. But I think a lot of people expected them to kind of fade and bleed into May and potentially, you know, get upset in the first round depending on the matchup they drew. I think they got a good hand with the Colgate draw. And then today, I think the whole world was overlooking them. Listen, when you have an elite professional quality attack midfielder who can draw leverage, like, you're never out of a game. And if you can make it a chess match, which is exactly what Kevin Warren just did, by the way. Like, I actually thought he really coached well today. If 12 wins his matchup today, Georgetown can win that game. But 27 and White is just that elite of a first-team All-American defenseman, where him and Tillman and Jesse were prepared. But the other thing I'll say about Tamberoni is to have the credibility in the room when you're down at half to look your team in the eye and say, listen, guys, their goalie heated up. Like, we need a couple saves, but the actual film is not as bad as we think. Like, we're in this thing. We're going to go to zone on the back end, and we're just going to chip away. We're going to chip away because the reality of lacrosse is a lot of people would have quit in that room. It's Notre Dame. It's the two-time defending champs. You know, you're getting slid on downhill. And this now sets up one of the most interesting moments with Tamberoni versus Cornell at the site of, like, the, you know, biggest heartbreak probably in the history of our sport, when you have a generational clearing midfielder in Max Siebold and you don't find a way to get him that rock. You have a pole carrying with 10 seconds left on the far sideline. So what a moment. And for everyone, I mean, they should be flooding from upstate to Gillette.
Well, they'll be heading from College Park to Foxborough, Massachusetts, as the Maryland Terrapins have just completed their 9-6 win over the Georgetown Hoyas. We're going to talk about that game at the end of the podcast. Let's get to what was just an absolutely unbelievable affair. Syracuse 19, Princeton 18. Joey Spallina, 4 goals, 4 assists. Forced the Tigers to switch the matchup early from Colin Mulshine to Jack Stahl, who emphasized denying him the ball when he was adjacent. I talked to a Division I assistant who was familiar with both these programs, and he said, this time of year, defenses try to take away their players' go-to, right? So Sammy English sweeping, Spallina's rocker, Bear Anderson getting under, Leo rollback. Good players can get to their spots and make plays, but it just didn't look to me as an observer like Princeton knew exactly who they were playing against. I looked at this game through my pregame expectations, which were, you know, I expected Johnny Mullen to win 60 to 70% of the faceoffs. I expected Princeton to score about 40% of the time. This was crazy to me. Johnny McCool had 3 games where he was under 40%, and then every other game he was over 50%. He did not have a lukewarm game. He did not have a 40% day on the year. I thought Ryan Kroduk was going to go over 50% because that's what we had saw. That's what we had seen. I thought both teams were going to clear well. And so really for me, kind of the wild card was exactly how good Syracuse's offense was going to be. And I felt like if they could get to 35%, they were going to win. Now, what I didn't account for was the fact that Anderson McMeekin turned Johnny Mullen into a jumper. He violated 7 times. That was McMeekin's problem all year and why he had struggled this year relative to last year, because he'd been trying to jump the whistle a bunch. Well, the guy who was kind of the consensus second-team All-American ended up jumping 7 times. Now, granted, there were 15 face-off violations in this game, so, you know, that was certainly, I don't know, in the water. Princeton scored on 42.9%. Both goalies were at 40%. Each team failed just 1 clear. Syracuse scored on 19 of 36 possessions. 54.3%. They scored more than half the time they had the ball. That was the difference. Joey Spallina was the difference. What an unbelievable storyline for, I'm not going to say Joey's the most famous player in the game. I think that's CJ Kirst, but Joey is the second most famous player in the game. He was a former number 1 recruit, and he has been trailed by this reputation of not performing in big games for 3 years. What an incredible storyline as he gets Syracuse, the team that went to 22 straight Final Fours until 2006. He gets them back to the Final Four for the first time since 2013. Just epic, epic storylines.
I had the distinct pleasure of, again, aforementioned, I was at a bachelor party this weekend. about half the group knew what lacrosse was, and half the group had absolutely no clue. So naturally, Will Corrigan, who's the assistant at Air Force, he was there this weekend, and we wanted the game on to be in a background. Everybody that attended and was even close to the TV was glued to it, starting from about halfway through the third quarter until the final whistle. Like, we were late to events because we were like, we're not missing the end of this game. And to watch people who know next to nothing about lacrosse, but are sports fans, get completely invested in the outcome. And they were literally flipping coins and saying, okay, I'm rooting for Syracuse, I'm rooting for Princeton. And they were like screaming at each other by the end of the game. So the way, Terry, that you teed it up, I think it was one of the all-time games from the Spallina storyline. You know, is Cuse back? That's always a stupid thing on Twitter every year, but now there's actually some justification to have that conversation. But even beyond that, there are a lot of people out there that just get looped into and forced to watch lacrosse. Maybe they're dating somebody who is invested. Maybe it's just on at a bar, whatever. This game, I think, made more fans from scratch than any other game I could remember. And at a certain point, I couldn't describe what was happening. Just, nope. Everything that you're going to see from both Syracuse and Princeton's offense is the only time that's ever happened in the history of the sport, from behind the back to around the world, to shovel pass, to, you know, fling and skip passes around, just as advertised, you know, jet fuel in the rocket ship. And my goodness, it was fun to watch people watch lacrosse.
Larkin.
Yeah, I think you guys did a really good job setting this up. I think that's the best the product can look. Like, that is the pinnacle of our sport. Like, if we got Bob Iger in a room for 2 hours and wanted to show him, like, the upside in our game, I mean, it was electric. Like, every moment, every possession, you know, hits, saves, controversial calls, you know, potential bad coaching decisions. It had everything you look for just in terms of, like, drama creation. And this kid's actually from my area, and, like, I hate to put a magnifying glass on it, but I do think it's important just for, like, analyst integrity. This game quite literally came down to a first-team All-Ivy defenseman who started 4 years, who has, like, a ton of quality film against Sam King and CJ Kirst. Like, honestly, just getting beat at the point of attack by 22 in orange. And Spies, Bath, Molshine got outplayed, candidly, by Dwan, Grace, etc. Like, if you think about the way in which Princeton had to initiate, it was a freshman, Peter Bonanno, Brown legend, bloodline, devastating, he's wearing that color, and Palumbo, right? So put differently, they negated the ability for Mackesy to, like, take over the game, right? And heading into it, especially not being in the dome, like, I think Spallina's film this year was, like, good, not great, away from home. And Molshine's a good player. Like, he has 3 to 4 years of, like, very quality film, right? He's not playing in some random conference against bad players. Like, you could argue CJ Kirst and Sam King are two of the best below GLE initiators and leverage creators to the strong hand in the game, and he held up on both those kids. So listen, it's devastating. I'm a defender. Like, I know it's eaten at him. It sucks. I think if you're Princeton, you probably should have gone into some sort of plan B earlier and not allowed 22 to heat up. But, like, the way you beat the Cuse is actually that plan. So I do want to give credit to Madelon in that I don't think the plan was bad. I don't think you want to create leverage for Hiltz and for English and for others on that offense. Like, I actually do think you want to put your best athlete on a slow-to-go island below GLE and try and hold up. And if Joey goes, let's call it 2-2, it's a different game. But, like, I will say this. This is what makes sport just so incredible. Like, if Kabiri one more is that pass to Burns and Princeton wins this thing by one, the whole world is talking about how, like, Gary Gate can't get it done and how Joey Spallino's, like, great but not elite, can't get the orange back championship weekend. And instead, right, it's, you know, what a moment for Syracuse. And, like, so it just gets at the core of, like, Princeton was right there. I mean, my goodness. I hated the last possession. Just I'll finish with this. I thought the two best players on the field were Bonanno and Palumbo all day. I think you got to put one of them high and wide. You got to get a front side action, like a slide, basically, and then spin it to the other and get them downhill. I did not like going to 91 in that situation. I didn't think the film was good enough all day on the left side.
Nick, we know you got to get out of here. You got a life to live. So this is the perfect final question to leave you with. Joey Spallina post-game interview. Your thoughts?
I absolutely loved it. Just every stupid burner, everything that he's had to hear. It was a moment in which you can do two things. You can kind of, I actually am unaware of what the rumors are about myself. And, I'm just focused on the job and credit to the other team and going into coach speak and blah, blah, blah. Or you can say, I've seen the douchebags out there online. Like, what could you possibly say now? And what are you going to say next? It doesn't matter because I just took this team to the Final Four. Loved it. Cocky. Pimped it. And he has been – I've kind of been waiting for that for 3 years.
The one thing I push back on in this narrative of, like, the orange is back, does anyone describe Brendan O'Neill at Duke not getting over the hump as back? Like, Syracuse is the top 4 to 5 resource program in our sport. They have the most championships in our sport. There is only one definition of back when you play at Syracuse, and that's finishing the season in a dog pile. So I think this narrative that, like, they've summited a mountain, while true in the sense of, like, media coverage, I hope that room is circling the wagons and not allowing the like, elation of being the team that got them there for the first time since 2013 to take away from the fact that they have a very winnable game next week, right? And their expectation when you recruit at the level they do and you're coached by one of the 4 best players in the history of our game, like, it's win or else. It's not we're back. Like, I don't know what that means.
Well, and I guess I would make the distinction before Larkin, goes off a cliff here. I mean, take a deep breath. I would make the distinction between Joey Spallina being game focused, game ready, performing at an extremely high level, and not caring about this whole narrative that is created out of the ether and fueled by dipshit burners who are scared to put their name out there. But in those moments where a reporter or the situation can kind of tee you up to dunk on people who have been talking shit about you for a while, I don't think it's compromising to the mission to say, hey, everybody take a suck.
No, I love the post-game interview, to be clear. So let me draw a line on that. I just more mean broadly the narrative. You hear about the alums, the Evan Malloy, like, everyone's dancing on graves. Like, man, this ain't Brown. This is Syracuse. Like, John Tillman makes the Final Four every single year. You know? He's not, like, running around saying, we're back, baby.
Well, and then, again, you feel free to dance on graves now, but if you don't get over the hump, the first person I'm texting is Evan Malloy. And I had no skin in the game until he started acting like every other Syracuse douchebag from Long Island. And now I have a list. He has a list. And then if Syracuse loses, boom, 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 boom.
Nick, go enjoy Vegas.
All right. Will do. Love you guys.
See you, bud.
Love you. Love you, I say.
Love you. Love you. Okay. Love you. What was your favorite play from that game? There were so, so many highlights to choose from. For me, it was the Bonanno dive.
Bonanno dive was incredible. I love that kid, by the way. I golf with him all the time, so shout out to him. Just an absolute coming out party. Like, I've obviously believed in him forever. But his dad's one of the all-time legends at our program, does a lot for us, so really happy for that family. But, yeah, the Bonanno dive, running over the goal.
Before moving on from that point, I want to shout out Chad Palumbo. The broadcast mentioned it, but, his cancer scare when he was a senior in high school was legit and real. And for him to weather and withstand that, come back, I thought the footage they showed during the broadcast was incredible. And then to immediately parlay that into he wants to be a broadcaster and then deliver the best in-game interview I think I've ever seen from a player or a coach was just awesome and so perfect.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, I thought Odierna and Syracuse did a far better job of, like, hey, we're going to make these two guys beat us. Now, to Princeton's credit, they did. And they were highly efficient. And, like, if they were playing any other team that day, they'd win 18-14, and we're not talking about this. I didn't think either goalie did enough to really impact the outcome, right? And we obviously expected Mullen to win the clamp. I think you did a great job outlining that they both seemed a little trigger happy. Like, I think something about the ref cadence or just the energy in Hempstead. It wasn't a particularly clean clamp and or wing play day. But, I mean, every time Syracuse spins the rock, like, the amount of creativity in the hand placement and, like, the arm angle from Hiltz, Thompson, whoever, it's just fun, man. Like, it, I was on the edge of my seat and just absolutely loved it. And I'm really happy for all of Upstate. Like, it's important to give credit in a sport where we need people to, like, deepen their roots and engage in regular season games and, like, build fandom and buy merchandise and all the different things that go into the flywheel. Like, Syracuse is the model. Like, it is, you know, it's more than a cult. Like, it's a way of life up there. It actually matters. And, like, I expect the attendance at Gillette to be elite from the Orange. And I hope a lot of fan bases kind of try and model their own foundation off of them. So really happy for everyone involved, the Spallina family, Gary, everybody. It was nice to see Paul on the field. I saw some cool videos of Paul with Gary after the game, everything they've been through. So really happy for everyone involved.
I want to touch on two of the things that we brought up with respect to, you know, Joey and the haters and the narrative of Syracuse being back, because I and our publication are central to the creation of both of those perceptions. So I wrote the feature in the recruiting issue where Joey was ranked number one. And I was very intentional with how I framed it. I think the misconception about Joey as being able to beat guys off the Dodge, and that was one of the two points that he made post-game, was I thought I wasn't able to beat anybody off the Dodge. And then the second being, I thought we couldn't win big games, is the reason that Joey was the number one recruit in the 2022 class in our eyes, or in mine, I don't really want to speak for anybody else, had less to do with his ceiling and way more to do with his floor. There was, so, and you think about it in the context of variance and the way in which you invest. Joey Spallina, it cares, first of all, he had been playing against older and bigger kids since he was in second grade, third grade, whatever. So by that, on that basis, there was very little concern about his ability to adjust to the quality standard, the level, especially because he had played with and against almost exclusively Division I players for the entirety of his youth. The second thing was he cares so much about lacrosse that I wasn't going to be concerned about behavior issues, wasn't going to be concerned about grades, wasn't going to be concerned about fitness, which, you know, had been an issue with some star Syracuse players. So that those are, you know, those are the things that raise the floor. The IQ and so the reason that his ceiling isn't super high is because his athletic attributes are not super high. He's like 5'10", probably plays at like 190, 195 maybe, is a really strong lower body as a result, but like isn't an overly strong player. And he's not super fast, super explosive, or super quick. So the comparison that I made was in terms of having a really high floor, but maybe not as high of a ceiling as some of the other, not just number one recruits, but some of the other highly sought after players in the class, is that there was just so few scenarios in which he wasn't going to be very, very, very good. And Shaq Stanwyck is somebody else who came to mind. Now, Shaq Stanwyck ended up playing basically half of his career with a couple of broken spinal bones and still put up 200 points at Johns Hopkins and went to the Final Four. So I feel really good about that comparison. Shaq Stanwyck had an incredibly high floor, met that floor. Injuries probably prevented him from reaching a ceiling that was super high beyond that floor. But I think that that's like, that is a justifiable way to either draft somebody number one overall or rank somebody number one in a recruiting class. And I think it's interesting to contrast it with two guys that you know very well who were ranked in the second half, you know, between 51 and 100, and it went on to win the Tord, one being Dylan Malloy, the other being Ben Reeves. Like, both those guys were the best player in their respective classes when it was all said and done. But you can understand how coming out of high school, there were questions about whether or not that ceiling was attainable for both of them. I mean, Ben Reeves was committed to Hobart, right? He was like 160 pounds when he got to New Haven. He graduated at like 215 or 220. So like that improvement wasn't assured and it wasn't built in. So Lark, I'm just interested in your thought on specifically the Dylan point and then what it means for the gap between high floor versus high ceiling.
I think you nailed it. When I watched Joey, I think that the reason at times that he blends in throughout the year is because he's almost always optimizing for the appropriate play, like as defined as someone who like grew up in a coaching household and is trying to execute at like a world games decision-making level, right? Where it's like, hey, Sean Light's covering me. Like, this isn't my day. We're going to spin it. We're going to let English attack. We're going to work the backside, blah, blah, blah. So there are moments where I think Syracuse faithful want him to be more aggressive and to go with more consistency and like get to his right-handed rocker. So let's compare that to Dylan. Dylan, every single time the ball spun through GLE, was going a million miles an hour, irrelevant of goal or turnover. Shoulder down, going to get to his spot and either, you know, do that kind of patented step back righty or roll and finish lefty. So like, I think what people love about Kirst is I think the percent of possessions where CJ is engaging with the intent to draw leverage is close to like 90, maybe 95. I don't think you can say the same for Joey, but I think to his credit yesterday, I'm assuming, you know, Pat March and Gary, they kind of had the conversation that like, listen, maybe we actually do respect Princeton's shorties. Maybe we don't think that, you know, Finn or whoever is going to be as successful as maybe in other weeks, other plans. So like, we want you to go hard for your right. And we want you to put 43 on skates and test him. Right. And that's not to say it was going to work. Maybe Molshan wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, or maybe someone pulled the fire alarm in Hempstead. Who knows? But put differently, a huge part of like being a primary ball carrier is testing your matchup early and figuring out and like feeling out, right, the rate at which they're going to come. And the second you see as 22 in orange that they're not coming at all, like you're on an island, you're in a phone booth, right? It's go time. So completely aligned on your Shaq Stanwyck comparable. And I think, frankly, Joey just plays with a lot better players at Cuse. Like, I think the world of Hilts and those kids. Like, I think that Joey will be a Touratine finalist next season, and he has every opportunity next weekend. I mean, ultimately, they've done the hard part, right? They've gotten over this physical or mental barrier of, like, Cuse hasn't been back to a Final Four, and now you're playing with house money. And, like, to be totally candid, I think the frustration for people like yourself who watch a lot of film is just the inconsistency this year. I don't think anyone doubts their upside. Like, I think there are moments where for 5 minutes in any game throughout this year where you're like, this is the best team in the country. But then they'll, you know, fall asleep and allow a team that hasn't won a clamp all day like Harvard to beat them at home, right? It's like, and I actually think Dwan and Grace and their back end should be better. Like, I don't think they do a good enough job of preventing people from getting to the middle, and they don't do a good enough job supporting their short sticks in particular. Syracuse is not a slide recovery team. Like, we're going to talk about Richmond in a second. Richmond slides and recovers with an urgency that it's life and death. Like, it's literally the ER. And I think Syracuse is just so used to practicing in a phone booth that, like, they try and play at a professional, basically, like, AJ help level, and it just doesn't work against Princeton. Like, Pipinano's good. Blumbo's good. But listen, I mean, credit to Joe. I'm sure it must have felt amazing. I'm sure he had, whatever, 500 people there watching. It's a field that his dad used to coach the Lizards on, and like it's just a really cool sports moment in a great sports weekend.
So to the point about Syracuse being back, we put a photo of Joey and Russell Melendez on the cover of the 2024 season preview of Inside Lacrosse that just said back. And it was McEnear's idea, and as soon as he said it, I fell in love with it. And the notion was – so this is the way that I think about it. I think that if you have a reasonable expectation of making it to the Final Four, you are a national champion contender, right? And I think that when you head into the season, there are, call it, four national championship contenders, right? The teams that are favored to make it to the Final Four. And then equivalently, if you're between 5 and 8, then you have a reasonable expectation of making it to the quarterfinals, and you are a Final Four contender, right? And then equivalently, if you are favored to make it to the NCAA tournament, then you are a quarterfinal contender. I think those are the three tiers of program stature. And Hawkins Hawkins had made it to the quarterfinals the year prior, so they were very clearly a Final Four contender. Syracuse hadn't made the tournament. And so, like, my contention was that they were both back as Final Four contenders heading into the 2024 season. Hawkins had a year of a head start or whatever. For Syracuse, they were a Final Four contender this year. They were a top four team by poll and Vegas futures heading into the season. And so they have met the expectation. They have not exceeded the expectation. You've used the term house money. You have said favorable matchup. I still am not going to pick them next week, right? So if they lose in the semifinals, I'm not going to say that Syracuse is back, but I'm also not going to say that Syracuse is not back, if that makes sense. Meaning that, like, for me, they will have just met the expectation. And you can make the stand, you can make the comment that the standard exceeds that expectation. I just will argue against that for any program, because I just, the standard is too high. Meaning that, like, there are too many teams that resource in a way that they can and should expect to make it to the Final Four. There's like 7 or 8, right? And so if you're one of those 7 or 8, then yes. And if you're not, they're still like that, the next tier is still like nipping at their heels, right? So I guess that's where I'll leave it for you. Is it a disappointing season if Syracuse loses to Maryland in the semifinals?
I don't think it's disappointing to the fan base. Like, I do believe that this was a kind of take a weight off the shoulder moment. But, like, just to be perfectly clear for everyone listening, if you ask John Tillman, or, like, if you surveyed the rest of Division I coaches, which roster would they rather have? Which set of input variables? Okay? Outside of the scope of this year, so just, like, coming into the season, let's call it. There's no question Syracuse has the better input variables. If you're in, like, a sum of the parts analysis, they have multiple players on offense who have more upside. And to your point, perhaps even a higher floor than the Spanos, the Fords, the whoever, right? So when Maryland is favored in Vegas next week, it just gets at the core of, like, Tillman, right? And culture, and expectation of culture. And the concept that Maryland's just played great defense forever. And, like, Syracuse won't be able to disrupt them into a track meet. And, like, Tillman will find a way to make it 8-6 late and win 9-6 with an empty netter like he did today. So, but, like, I actually think, and I genuinely believe if Gary took a polygraph, he would admit this. I don't think he got that much out of his group in 23. Like, I think he looks back on that with regret. And, like, even last year at moments, I'm not sure they found their upside. So I just think this was, like, a culmination where we finally, this was like a stock that you buy. It's a great business model, but it's, like, kind of chopping. It's not performing that well. And, like, then it just exploded in Hempstead. But is it going to explode at Gillette? I'm not sure. Like, Billy Dwan has every, like, type of input variable, which is why he was so highly regarded as a recruit coming out, to be 27 in Maryland, right? Like, but Jesse and Tillman and that culture of poll creation, they just do a better job so far. So I think it's a really interesting question. I think a huge piece of it is just, like, everything you're nailing around standard. But I just hope that for Syracuse's sake, and candidly for our game, like, there's only one definition of bad for Syracuse, and it's a dog pile. Like, that's just a fact. And whether it's Joey who gets that done, or whether it's the next great recruit, because he was there in person at Hempstead tailgating with his dad, and he was like, I want to go to Syracuse to play lacrosse, right? So that moment this weekend is just critical to fortifying Syracuse as a place that elite ball carriers want to play. I mean, that was showtime. Like, that was legitimate, like, magic is the term I'd use. And there's really only a few places you can get that. I mean, that game was as good as it gets.
The point about 23 is an interesting one, because my contention is that you just don't win with freshmen. And there were way too many freshmen that they were relying on. And then the reason that I felt like they were positioned to take a step, substantial step forward in 24 was because of the Princeton transfers, English and Stevens. Those guys had played in a Final Four. They knew what it took. And, you know, I also thought Christian Mille was going to provide a little bit of a dynamic that was going to take some pressure off Joey. And ultimately, they did. They took significant strides. They won a tournament game. They, you know, laid an egg in the quarterfinals. They learned how to both win and lose in the NCAA tournament. And then I think it's inarguable that Saturday was the culmination and the fruition of that. Let's keep this rolling and talk about Cornell 13, Richmond 12. Again, I want to frame this through the context of my pregame expectations relative to what we ended up seeing. So I thought that Cornell was basically going to outscore Richmond by one each quarter. I just thought they were incrementally going to pull away, because Jack Escadden, in my opinion, was a significant and clear advantage over Jared Chinoy. And I thought that Cornell's offense was clearly enough the better unit. And I think about it specifically in contrast to the Syracuse-Princeton game, where Princeton's offense was the better unit, in my opinion, but they were suffering from the possession disadvantage of not, again, pregame expectations, not being fed the ball the way that Cornell was going to be. And so I just felt like, you know, the incremental component of it. And the way that I thought about it was that if Cornell plays tight, and I don't mean it in the sense of like not loose, I mean in the sense of clean, then they'll control the game and they'll win a comparatively lower scoring game. So I was thinking like something in the neighborhood of 12-8, 14-10, somewhere in that range. If they played sloppy and the game got higher tempo, which is not the way Richmond typically wants to play, but I think that they knew that they were going to have to take advantage of their opportunities in transition if Cornell was giving them to them, then in that scenario, it would be closer to like a 16-12 game. And what ended up happening was, ultimately why I felt like Richmond wasn't going to be able to win a game where Cornell was incrementally pulling away was because I didn't anticipate the Spiders having the depth of scoring necessary in order to be able to keep it close. And once again, the reason that I look at it through pregame versus postgame expectations is because of how wrong I was and what was wrong about those pregame expectations. Ultimately, the faceoff game went roughly as I expected. But if I had told you that Lucas Littlejohn was held scoreless and Richmond was still able to get to 12, I don't know how they would have been able to do that. And it was depth of scoring. Charlie Packard had 3 goals coming in, 2 in the prior game, 1 in 2 games prior to that. Leo Kane had 11 goals coming in. Henry Alpaugh had 11 goals coming in. Those guys combined for 3 goals. Those are huge. It's huge offense production, huge output. And I felt like it was the combination of, you know, we've talked a lot this season about Cornell's improvement defensively. And I think there were a couple of ways in which that manifested. Number one, not being able to continuously attack one particular spot. I felt like you didn't really see that. And then number two was being able to prioritize taking away a known and executing it. And I think that that's ultimately what ended up happening with Littlejohn. So I give a ton of credit to the way in which Dan Shamati and his group prepared the all-around offensive game plan, right? They basically said, our job is to score goals. It's not to get X player to score the goals. And I thought that was really well executed. And then secondly, the thing that stood out, and I'm very curious as to how this came through on the TV for you. So the way my day unfolded, I went to the Bandits NLL game one final, NLL final game one on Friday night. I flew from Buffalo home on Saturday morning, came immediately, like I said, to Navy to pick up our staff's credentials, and then went home. So I got settled in to watch this game basically with like 11 or 12 minutes to go in the third quarter, then went back and watched the first half after all the games were done. In the moment, for like 6-7 minutes, that like, you know, call it 12-minute to 5-minute stretch of the third, I was like, not only is Richmond playing harder, but they look like they have more juice, more energy, more pop. I felt like the only two Cornell players who were playing with energy were Goldstein and Firth. And so credit to Ryan Goldstein because, you know, without him, this is like a relatively lopsided game. CJ Kirst, in some instances, and Hugh Kelleher for sure, looked like they were running in sand. And I was amazed to find after the game that CJ Kirst picked up 10 ground balls and caused 3 turnovers. And I believe that he's either tied or has passed Gavin Adler in career caused turnovers. An incredible way to impact winning when you are otherwise not producing offensively the way that you are expected to. And so ultimately, and I thought Connor Busick did a really nice job of summarizing this post game, it was a culture win for the Big Red, something that you've not only mentioned on this podcast with respect to other programs as well, but something that you're familiar with having played Cornell throughout your college career, particularly in a couple seasons when the culture wasn't as buttoned up as it has been in the last couple of years. Larkin, your thoughts on Cornell's 13-12 win over Richmond?
Gutsy is the word I'd use. And I think it was an extremely long bus ride home for Richmond because when you draw up the bullet points of like, how are we going to try and chip away at this monster that is 15 and white, right? Like, he shot and made decisions with the rock as poorly as I've seen him make all year, which is exactly what you need. I mean, I think he was like two goals, 2 assists, maybe 13 shots, something crazy like that.
So, yeah.
So extremely low efficiency. That's exactly what you need. And not only that, I actually thought Zach Vige was like seeing the ball on him. Like the goalie was moving well. And at no point on film was I concerned about that matchup. Just so everyone understands.
Saved him four times. And you wonder how much that contributes to missing the cage seven times.
There's anyone who listens to this religiously or weekly has heard me talk about high field defense. The greatest advantage in knowing that you're going is that everyone's playing on your toes, right? It's not, you're not sitting in mud saying, oh, is Yazo beat? And do I have to slide? It's I'm sliding. I'm flushing. I'm going. Who's my fill? You're my fill. Okay, we're bumping. We're U-turning. Where's my recovery? Like every single possession to the left side of the field, Richmond was not only prepared to go, but they were actually flowing that way. Like it looked like a wave receding, like tidal energy. Great defense, high field defense, is it should look like waves on a beach or like a push-pull, you know, like a car, basically, engines, pistons firing. Like it's mechanical. It's boom, boom, boom. What Cornell did a really good job of, and this is actually important context, Cornell does not play in the ACC. They play in the Ivy where teams slide and recover because you have to. If you play defense at Brown or Dartmouth or Harvard even, like you do recover and you have to go because we don't have the short stick athletes. Because of that, Busick did not panic and he just made slight adjustments. The places you want to attack a high fill team are the low wing and your secondary matchups. And Goldstein won them this game, and long to Dalton on the pipe is an exact example of if you take a picture at the start of a high wing dodge that then becomes a low wing dodge, the high fill is put on skates because the low pipe opens up as a skip lane. Because it's on the backside, there's a push-pull occurring where you have one playing two, but if they have appropriate spacing, like in real time, he needs to go from picking the high hammer to the low hammer. And that's the hardest cover in sports. And really, really elite defenses will actually intentionally put poles on the backside so that I can use my stick to cover more space. But in both those moments, it was a short stick back there. So I feel for Richmond. They didn't clear very efficiently. They got the ball back with like a buck 40 left and had their top clearing midfielder with the rock, and he turned that ball over, and that was the game. And the other just moment I want to call out is a truly crazy decision, in my opinion, but it worked. Jordan Stevens having the confidence to go zone when his goalie was fighting it all day with 30 seconds left on the clock. Just so everyone realizes, when you go zone, by definition, you're not going to give up a dunk most likely because you're not going to go like 1v1 matchups and let them spread the field, right? So you're not what an offense wants to do, obviously, is lengthen slides and create leverage. What a defense wants to do is determine who and how someone gets a shot. But when you do go zone, there's basically a guarantee, unless they piss the rock away, which they did, that a big, strong, primary-handed player is going to get their hands free from, let's call it, like 12 to 14 yards. No different than man up, right? And I thought Cornell's goalie was awful all day. So I thought that was extremely risky from Jordan. But it did the job. It worked. But I just want to double down on what you said. I thought Richmond's midfielders, specifically Sheridan, extremely deceptive dodgers, and by deceptive, what I mean by that is as they created contact in the high alley, it was very hard for Staub and Dooley and whoever who were playing behind ball to tell if their short sticks were beat. Like, they're not as fast as a Matt Trainer or as a Michael Leo or as a Pete Bonanno or as a whoever. It's like a lot harder to tell in real time if they're beat, but they were beat, and Richmond was doing a great job of getting in the middle of the field and getting their hands free. And I thought Richmond did basically everything right and still couldn't get over the hump. And that's what it takes to win a championship. So if you're Cornell, you take a big sigh of relief out and, you know, you live to fight another day. But I do think that you and I, you know, because of the nature of how much film I watch the Ivy, like I've gone back and forth on this. I just want to, again, identify. I don't know if the short stick defensive midfielders for Cornell are good enough to win a championship. Like, they have to cover those guys up on a weekly basis, and luckily they can because Kirsten, that side of the rock, is just that good. And if you get that type of performance from Goldstein or Firth or Long, you're going to be really hard to beat. But we'll see. Just to call this out now, like 22 in the alley off of a switch on Cornell shorties is not a good recipe for next week for Penn State. So like, if I'm Penn State, this is going to sound crazy, but I thought today was a harder matchup for Penn State. Like, I actually think they match up okay with Cornell. They've beaten Cornell this year, right? So this is very exciting. And with the Tambroni narrative, I mean, just what a weekend shaping up, both for us just to build momentum, but also for the ball.
You called out a couple sequences. I want to do the same thing. 6:28 to go in the third quarter. Cornell scores to cut Richmond's lead to 9-8. Jack Kaskaden wins the following faceoff. CJ Kirst's shot, 5:21 to go, saves Zach Vigue. Cornell retains possession. I think the ball went out of bounds on a rebound, and they backed it up. 4:51, Michael Long, save Zach Vigue. 4:41, Brian Lovesy comes up with a ground ball after 10 seconds. 3:54, shot, Ryan Goldstein, hit post, ground ball pickup, Ryan Sheen. 3:21, Andrew Dalton, shot, save, Zach Vigue. Michael Long, pick up the ground ball, 3:19. They got five shot clock resets, the Big Red did, between 6:28 and 3:19. Turnover, Ryan Goldstein, ground ball pickup, Michael Farrell, clear attempt, good. Goal, Richmond, 1:48. They get the lead back out to 10-8. You just withstood a 4.5-minute defensive possession and then scored. Like, if I mean, there were a lot of things that happened in the first half where it kind of felt like, you know, you kind of spin it both ways. Like, it's not our day, right? There was a bunch of, like, weird things that kind of happened against Richmond from the standpoint of, like, turn the ball over or making bad decisions or whatever. Kind of, like, a bad start that still wasn't as bad as Carolina. So, like, maybe we're not going to be as hopeless or whatever. But then also, like, you know, the bounce that goes in. There were a couple of things where it was like, all right, maybe it is our day. When you have that sequence, I have to think that that was the moment when the bench really started to believe. You know, like, there's always the question of, like, all right, can we actually do this? Like, Cornell's the number one team in the country. Obviously, we played them tough in the regular season, but, like, you know, we've never made it to the Final Four before, and they've been to, like, 25. Like, are we really going to beat them and do this? I have to believe that that was the moment where that happened. And then there's a sequence that I'm very afraid that I'm going to get this, like, moderately wrong. I believe – so Cornell scored with 5:28 to go, and that was the last goal of the game. It made it 13-12. Richmond won the following faceoff, had a possession that ended with a shot clock violation, with 4 minutes to go. There were two sequences, and I can't remember whether it was the first or the second. I believe it was the second, but I think the box score suggests it was the first. Either way, Cornell had played like a pretty stressful, strenuous, you know, stretch of defense. And I think it was 77 Gilmartin that had carried the ball over the midline. And I kept wondering, like, when are you going to pressure ride and try to get the ball back? And it was 42 Merklinger who had, you know, he was the leading scorer on the day for the Spiders. So I don't want to, like, you know, really call him out. He had a good day, but it was just like, if it was Gilmartin, whichever clearing midfielder for Cornell gets the ball over the midline, basically still has his heels on the midline. And I'm like, pressure him, like go try to disrupt something. And instead, Richmond allowed Cornell to sub, didn't kind of use that opportunity to try to get the ball back. You know, ultimately they did get the ball back. And like you said, like, they had opportunities to win the game, but it just felt like in that sequence, you know, that was the part where I really felt like there was an opportunity to take advantage of Cornell's fatigue and try to use that to force a bad decision. And when they didn't, I thought Richmond let Cornell off the hook, and they had an opportunity that they let slip through their fingers, so to speak.
I completely agree with that. I also just want to double down on too many empty possessions. Like, everyone on that field knew Nuss was fighting it, right? I think he ended up with five saves, maybe 12 against. Like, gotta find a way late in clock, even if it's going to be, let's call it, contested and, like, not a high percentage play. Got to find a way to earn your strong hand and just get it on net. Like, throw it at his knees, make him make saves, right? And, I mean, just to call out a stat, I mean, Richmond ended up clearing 20 for 27. Cornell was 12 for 12. So that gets at the core of, like, can we really do this? Cornell has played in big moments. Like, everyone on that field has been to a Final Four. Everyone in that field, you know, has played championship Ivy League tournament lacrosse, played in huge games on TV. Like, Richmond, that was a big moment for them. Let's just call it what it is. Like, there aren't huge crowds in the A-10, and you don't play in big stadiums. Like, so my heart, like, breaks for them a little bit. And then to give credit, I think our sport does a really good job of identifying, like, the Cavanaughs as hard riders, great off the ground. Like, Kirst has built an elite culture of ground ball play at Cornell where, listen, if you see your senior captain, who's an attacker, most, like, attackers, candidly, are divas, as, like, the one of the best ground ball players in the nation, like, the whole team digs in on that KPI. They won the turf 51-27 on a hot day on Long Island. And that it's those little moments that are the difference. And the other thing is their pulls don't foul, which is really important. It's hard to get upset when you don't foul. Like, they didn't put Richmond on man up. They didn't allow Sheridan or whoever, Little John, to heat up, getting their hands free on just step downs, 3v2 push pulls. So it goes back to culture. Like I think what Busick and Stevens have done at Cornell, they've very quickly elevated, in my opinion, to the second best cultural coaching staff of just like belief. Like Tillman is by far and away number one in my opinion, but at no point did that group panic. And you know, let's go Reds going back to championship weekend. I'm sure my girlfriend's very excited. I know she is. I will not be attending with her.
Let's bring this home. Number three seed, Maryland Terrapins, going back to the Final Four. Just learned they're playing the second semifinal. Shocker. 9-6 victors over Georgetown. You can probably, you know, slice up this game any number of ways, but most of them are going to show how narrow the margin was and how it was decided in a couple of key sequences. So 9 faceoffs won for either team. Ross Prince winning 8 of 15. Jonah Carrier winning 9 of 12. Saves. Anderson Moore made 12. Logan McNaney made 11. The Terps jumped out to a 2-0 lead at the end of the first quarter. Georgetown got just one shot on goal in the first quarter. They settled into the game and took a 4-3 lead halfway through the second, 5 minutes to go, excuse me, in the second. And then the Terps respond. I think this was pivotal. Ursa Spanos, Keegan Ford, right before halftime to give Maryland a 5-4 lead. Zach Whittier extends it to a 6-4 lead. And then on two occasions, Georgetown responds to cut a 2-goal lead back to 1, the second being the Goldberg goal that you heard at the beginning of this podcast. And then Irksa, Larkin, you talked about it in real time, and then Daniel Kelly with the nail hammer to make it 9-6 with 2:21 to go. Earlier this season, I made the point that I think Daniel Kelly's story of improvement is one of the most compelling in all of college lacrosse. He was a lefty mid-range shooter who has added more ball movement and playmaking and more dodging to his game relative to what his role was. And it's really compelling from the standpoint of the balance between improving, like strengthening your strengths or strengthening your weaknesses. And ultimately it was his strength that ended up being the goal that secured this win and sent the Terps back to the Final Four. But you pointed out a couple times already in this podcast, a really nice job by Kevin Warren to put his team in a position where had they made the plays, you know, one of the things I love about the NBA is the distinguish between crunch time, which I believe is 5 points within the last 5 minutes, to clutch time, which is one possession in the last 2.5 minutes. Georgetown got the game to crunch time. You know, they were down one inside 8 minutes to go. Irksa scored 3 seconds later, and they weren't able to get the game to clutch time. What were your takeaways on this one?
I think it really just came down to 27 and White on 12 and Blue. Like, I think I thought Kevin did a great job today preparing his group. I think that he did enough, right? Taking that 4-3 lead, extending the rock fight, you know, just making it a phone booth battle of like a true chess match. I mean, everything you need to know about these two guys is like ESPN shows the segment where Warren drops into the Tillman press conference. They're like best buddies. And then Warren takes a timeout at 19 seconds left in the first half. And they've now outlawed this in college football. But like Tillman then immediately takes the timeout because he wants to just see on his iPad where he put the different midfielders to then predict what they're going to do, spinning it backside and like who's going to dodge low wing. I mean, that level of attention to detail and coaching in a sport that has a lot of flow, like to compare that to how Gary coaches at Cuse as an example, I mean, it's just so different. But I was laughing in a couple group chats, like no one has the ability to take the air out of a quarterfinal weekend quite like John Tillman in terms of like three just high flying matchups, high scoring affairs where like the knowns are filling it up. You just felt like him and Jesse on the backside would be able to, and they're very vocal about it. They're like, listen, on film, we think Bayman 2, right, and 12 are kind of their, let's call it leverage creators, and we're going to live with our athletes on everyone else, right? And we're going to flow front side to 12. We're going to support 27. Like, I think 27 is the best defenseman in college across. I don't think it's close. Like, he, even when the ball is two passes away from him, his level of engagement, like as a field general and as a slide decision maker, you can actually see in his body language that he is like pushing the primary side, directing traffic of the U-turn recovery of like what exactly he wants his short six to do. If you compare that to Sean Light, like if I just clipped film as if this was a professional draft to his level of engagement while Trainer was dodging today, totally different players. both elite players, but totally different. Truly a complete defenseman, in my opinion, with Will. So I just thought it was really impressive. And this gets back at the core. I mean, we've said it all year, and like every Maryland fan who listens to this loves it, but Tillman is just so consistent. And to beat him at this stage, you have to get a truly like elite performance out of your ball carriers. And I love 12. I thought he was so good last week at Duke. He just wasn't able to like burst through that ceiling and give them 5-1 today, which they needed, right? And that's really the only way to beat him. Like, ultimately the Terps are going to live and die by their standards and their fundamentals, and they're going to force like the unknowns, if you will, to beat Logan from 15 yards, let's call it. And they had a few chances for that. I thought Georgetown had a couple good looks. They needed one in White to play poorly, and instead he went, I don't know, 60% probably. The refs did not insert themselves into the game. I did think the foul on 27, you could argue, I guess, slightly late, but I think they ended up locking it in. Other than that, the refs didn't insert themselves and create some form of drama. It was just two great coaching staffs going toe-to-toe, exchanging blows. I had predicted 7-5 and ended up 9-6. I mean, this is exactly what I think most of the world expected.
McNaney finished with 11 saves, 64.7%. Anderson Moore had 12 saves, 57.1%. They were two of only three goalies this weekend that finished above 50%. Zach Vigue being the other that, like you mentioned. What does that say about kind of the point that you just made in terms of nobody can take the air out of quarterfinal weekend like John Tillman, that, there were only three out of eight goalies that finished above 50% and two of them were from this game?
I think it says that there's two coaching staffs, both that were on the field, that do a really good job of like instilling fundamental habits in their short sticks in particular around like, we will not get beat to the middle. Like, listen, my team is not playing at this point in May. I'm in no way trying to like throw shade, but the Princeton defense and Syracuse defense, if you just clipped it from certain moments in that matchup, was like god awful. Like, they were allowing like primary one-handed dodgers, like big L, little R, like don't get beat to the L, don't give up the middle. Like, they were getting blown by to the middle, right? So I think, like, this is a Tillman, I would argue this is maybe his best coaching performance ever, which is insane to say, but there are no alphas on that offense. Like, I honestly think, and this is going to sound crazy considering the amount of film we watch, if you took the numbers away from their offensive personnel, like, it would be very hard for even us to, like, determine who the hell anybody is. They all look the same. They all are kind of, let's call it, like, the fifth
through as long as Spanos is wearing that weird knee brace that nobody else wears that looks like it's from 1975, I'd be able to pick him out. But otherwise, you're right. They're all five.
By the way, like, to give further compliments to everything that staff's doing, Phipps, etc. Like, if we were just running a professional franchise, which of those players on Maryland's offense would go in front of like the top six offensive players on Syracuse this year? Like, I think Willem Fert's more talented. I think you could argue Goldstein's more talented. Like, every team left, Trainer, of course, like, every team left has a form of input variable that is true, like, alpha creation. It's like, oh, that's CJ Kearse. He's 6'2", 220, and gets downhill every time, right? Maryland doesn't have that this year. And they have some elite players on the back end, but what they really have is elite culture stemming back from the Michael Earhart years, and really that's just extended for now a decade plus of, like, there is some kid who's currently a freshman who's watching 27 and who's going into summer, no matter what happens, whether they end in a dog pile or they get their heart ripped out, being like, I'm going to be the next great. And like, he's going to work out that way and he's not going to get a finance internship. Like, he's going to go to the gym and he's going to be the next Tim Mueller, Bryce Young, you name it. So it's just, what more can you say? Like, we spend the whole year talking about, well, is Cuse back? Well, is Duke going to get hot? It's like, man, Maryland has arguably less resources than either of those programs. Like, John Tillman wanted to stay at Harvard if the Harvard AD didn't blow that relationship. He wouldn't have even been at Maryland. Like, and now, what is it, 22 straight tournaments, 11 out of 14 Final Fours? I mean, this guy, he's consistent as gravity. I mean, he's just downhill in May. And really happy for Mike Daly. He's on that staff. Hope he obviously gets a look here in the cycle. Just setting up for an elite championship weekend. Like, I'm a homer. I'm a New Englander. Rhode Island is 40 minutes from Gillette. But, like, this is a championship weekend that we as a sport need to rally around. You cannot get a better group of teams, better group of head coaches. You have a all-time great and cursed. I mean, what more can you ask for? I think the weather's shaping up good. If you want to play golf in the morning on the off days, like the women's bracket is there as well. I mean, just really high quality stuff. So really excited for everyone.
It's a great note to end on. People were asking for rumor boys. Do you have a rumor boys segment?
Yeah, I think, well, listen, the reality of the rumor boys is like one of the things I hate in this sport is that we have a hesitancy to engage in drama. Like, I don't like the fact that, you know, you are put under an impossible position to, like, confirm something that we both know is true and you don't want to release it because, like, the wife's going to find out and yell at you or whatever. And I would just
encourage... To be clear, he's not talking about my wife. He's talking about somebody
else. No, he's talking about coaches. And I would just, like, remind everyone that we all have the same goal. Like, my goal is not to, like, break someone's heart when their kid opens Twitter and, like, I'm leaking that X is occurring. It's that I want coaches to get paid more. Like, I want coordinators to have a full-time wage and, like, their kids to be set up for success. The way that all occurs is we create off-season drama. So, you know, I didn't, like, ask for this, but I've elevated into a position where I'm getting DMs that have a form of credibility. I didn't leak anything crazy. I just basically said, hey, there's some not, you know, there's some rumor boy action occurring. Everyone take a hard look at that. You know, what happens over the next week in at Homewood or at Chapel Hill or wherever, that's not my decision. Like, the AD is having a postmortem on the season, and I'm sure, you know, jobs we haven't even thought of. Like, the Hobart thing came out of nowhere, right? So, like, our sport, you know, people are making more money, which implies the standard is higher, and there are young, hungry ADs who want to reshape athletic departments in their own way. Like, people are going to get canned. It is what it is. And ultimately, like, water finds its level. Great coaches like John Tillman will get extended. And others won't, and it is what it is, but it's my job to educate.
Well said. Larkin Kemp, we appreciate your time on the Tailgate Podcast. If you're listening, like what you heard, leave a rating, a review, tell a friend. We'll be back next week with more Tailgate Podcasts and a national champion, a new national champion for the first time in 3 years.
Let go. Buy tickets. Promo code in the pod. Let's go.